The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to welcome you and our guest, Syed Kashua, this evening. A columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz for the past 10 years, as well as the author of three highly regarded novels and the long-running sitcom Arab Labor, Syed Kashua has amassed an international following for his often satirical prose that are tinged with humor and loss. His novels include Dancing Arabs, a Bildungsroman that also served as the basis for the film Borrowed Identity, Let It Be Morning, and most recently, Second Person Singular, about which a reviewer in the Los Angeles Times writes, Kashua's dry wit shines with each of the main characters, offering windows into the prejudices and longings of Arabs and Jews. The themes are universal in a world in which every culture, it seems, has an other against which to play out prejudice and feelings of supremacy. Kashua's latest book, Native, Dispatches from an Israeli-Palestinian Life, collects his favorite columns from his time at Haaretz. Gary Steingart calls Kashua a brilliant, funny, humane writer who effortlessly overturns any and all preconceptions about the Middle East. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Syed Kashua.
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much. Okay, so first of all, I would like to apologize for my English, especially when I read. I'll be stuck, and you might help if you wish sometimes. I might cry, but I will stay. Sometimes I cry and run away, but this time I will try to stay on stage. Because I'll be reading from Native. It's a collection of columns. I started writing for Haaretz back in the beginning of 2005, I guess. And the collection, of course, it's the first columns is from April 7th, 2006, and it goes up to until June 2014. I think it was one of the last columns that I wrote before leaving Israel in favor of Champaign, Illinois. I do live now in Urbana-Champaign. That's not funny. Actually, it's not funny at all. But it's wonderful. I very much love the university, and the people are so great. It's flat, but it's but I do need reasons to still miss home. So I think Urbana-Champaign is a good place to still imagine the last Eden of the Middle East. And to be honest, I was just looking at the book recently because I needed to practice for the readings. I didn't want to read the book and the columns. I knew that it can be very sad sometimes. And it was sad to read the columns that I used to write for 10 years for Haaretz. The humor, the struggles, you know, the birth. When I started writing the column, I was married and used to live in Beit Safafa with my wife and my daughter. She's now 15, but back then she. So two boys were born while writing the columns, at least I guess. So it's all there, and some of the characters, wonderful characters in the book, like my grandmother and my father, passed away already, and they used to be great characters in the novel. And of course, my wife, and thanks God she's not here, and she's a very busy psychotherapist now doing her PhD. because if she had time to read the things that I've been writing about her, yes. Okay, I'll start with something, and I very much hope that I will give you the chance to ask questions. Okay, so I'll begin with yes, I don't want to. September 7th, 2007. No one takes me seriously. Everyone thinks I'm being funny all the time. The truth is, this is not everyone's problem. It's mine. I can never say no. Lately, I've been thinking that it's a genetic thing, or maybe cultural, even though I know that cultural and economic status are no less genetic than Down syndrome. I inherited, was taught, or simply developed an inability to be unequivocal with my nose. When I entered the Jewish world, meaning when I started to work for Jewish bosses who were usually older than me, whenever there was something I was asked to do but didn't want to, I said, inshallah, which is the politest word I can use with someone who's older to say, I don't want to. Jews treated inshallah as though it means yes, but it doesn't. When an Arab says, inshallah, I will come at 5 o'clock to fix your faucet in the bathroom, he's actually telling you, forget it, I don't have time, call another plumber. That's how I found myself, owing to a mistaken use of inshallah, washing dishes in a restaurant that I happened to eat in, leaving the university and becoming the sex slave of the owner of a steak joint who was on far side of the 60. So you're meeting me in the store room later on, inshallah. Afterwards, when I found out that inshallah has different meanings in other cultures, I switched to I don't think I want to. Still, politeness is politeness, and I really but really cannot say no, certainly not to a Jew. It's a caste thing. After the boss in the restaurant was arrested for some illicit financial activity, I started to rehabilitate my life. I re-enrolled in Bezalel Academy of Art, taking photography courses and enjoying every minute. When the time came that I needed money for paper and developing materials on a scale that I could no longer ask my parents for, I started to look for work in the profession. I went to the editor of a local paper with a portfolio and a camera slung over my shoulder and asked if they needed freelance photographers. Photographers we don't need, he said, and asked, tell me, are you an Arab? Yes, I nodded my head. Can you write? Yes. We are looking for a reporter on Arab affairs. What do you say? I don't think I want to, I replied. Following this wrong use of I don't think I want to, I found myself getting heart attacks in Gaza and Jenin, crying with hungry children, fleeing from snipers from both sides, interviewing wanted individuals and settlers, and trying to escape from helicopters. When the war stopped being sexy, I found myself interviewing models and dog barbers, writing about television, cars, nightlife, restaurants, pimps, and whores. A good few years passed until I adopted the rejection statement, that's not for me. I rehabilitated my life, wrote books, saved up money, and got a girlfriend. Do you want to get married? That's not for me. Is there a big hall in the village? That's not for me. 1,000 guests? That's not for me. Honeymoon in Anatolia? No, that's really not for me. A child? That's not for me. Another one? That's not for me. What about a third? No, I don't want to. Do you hear? I don't want to. Fine, since when have you become so unequivocal? That's it, I don't want to. With a powerful put-down assertion, I don't want to, I wrought miracles. I worked only in jobs that I wanted to have. I wrote only what I wanted. So simple, how had I survived without the words I don't want to? I wrote a screenplay and a television series that I wanted to write, and then I started to get a lot of calls from producers and big agents, a real success story, until recently when people who don't take no for an answer started to approach me. Already in the first meeting with the first producer who offered me a job writing a telenovela, I whipped out the put-down response that had saved me in recent years. I don't want to. With producers and agents, it turns out that the word no is not an option. It's like in The Godfather. You cannot say no to a serious producer. At most, you can hit him with inshallah and pray he will leave you alone. Five producers to whom I said I don't want to came back with no is not an option. Suddenly, my no is being defied. Sure you want to, but you just don't know yet that you want to. That's another sentence you often hear from businessmen with plenty of money. Oh, really? So you are saying that I do want to? Sure you want to. Voila, I don't know, because the truth is that I don't feel so comfortable, and anyway, I don't have time. Do you want $50,000? Yeah, sure, that's something I really want. So you see that you want to? You were right. Okay, within a month, I want a musical for a huge production starring all the children's heroes. Inshallah. I take it you have no trouble composing music either. Inshallah. Okay, that was the first one. Thank you. Thanks. But it was sad that not being able to say no. And that's not, when I received the phone call from the University of Urbana-Champaign, I didn't say inshallah. I said, yes, I want to come. It was not, okay. Yes, okay. Anti-hero, it's better. Actually, it's better not to give a talk, but I'll answer your questions later. Anti-hero. We have to leave the country, I informed my wife. It's a column that I wrote just a week before the third novel, Second Person Singular, was released. So it's April 30, 2010. We have to leave the country, I informed my wife as I went over the final proofs. We won't be able to stay here after this book is published. Don't exaggerate, my wife said. You're not the only one. There are a lot of bad writers and none of them is thinking about this. None of them is thinking about escaping from the country because of another embarrassing book. No, it's not that, I tried to explain. The problem is the characters in the book. What? Are you trying to tell me that this time you managed to use your imagination and created a character who's not me? Terrific, terrific. Keep hounding me. You don't have a clue about how serious the situation is. And now that I think about it, I want you to know that it's all your fault. Me? You're blaming me? You know that without me, you wouldn't manage to write one sentence. Because of that, it's too bad. You're not a little different. What do you want? What do you want from my life now? Nothing. Not a thing. I wanted to end the conversation, but I couldn't stop myself. Couldn't you be a little more militant? I hurled at the main character who was lying next to me. Couldn't you be a little bit more activist? Go to demonstration, go to marches, get arrested? What? Why not? I snapped. You get arrested for nationalist motives. What's the problem? A nation under occupation and you are busy with twaddle like studies, work, home, and children? Fine, she retorted. That's the word? And turned her back on me. Do me a favor and let me get some sleep now. Unlike you, I have to get up for work tomorrow. Ya Allah, what I'm doing now? What I'm gonna do? That's it. The book is going to press. There's nothing left to save. Where was I all these years? Only now, 6 years after I wrote the first sentence, only now, just before it goes to press, do I grasp the gravity of what I've done? What exactly was I thinking when I started to write this thing? What am I, an idiot? What exactly did I think I was living? Switzerland? Tell me, I shook my wife. Do me a favor, let me sleep. Who do you vote for anyway? For whichever party promises to get you out of here, she said, and went back to sleep. Again, I had come up with heroes. Heroes, I called them? What kind of heroes? Nothing. I came up with nonentities, afraid of their own shadows. And I promised my father that my next book would make me a national hero, Palestinian, I mean. With pathetic characters like these, every beginning Arab journalist will make mincemeat out of me and become a national hero himself. Once more I had fallen asleep on the watch. Once more I had entered into my story to the point where I forgot about the reaction of those around me. But there's nothing that can be done now. It's too late, only to escape, just to pack my bags and hightail it out of here, to find a place where a writer doesn't have to bear on his shoulders any burden heavier than the story he's trying to tell, a place where writers do not feel a need to be national symbols. Oh, how I would like to be like Mahmoud Darwish. And I'm not talking here only about outward appearance. I just know that at this moment some readers are cursing inwardly and saying, how does this wretch who has no talent and above all has no values dare dream of even getting close to the shoes of national poet? They're right. Darwish didn't even write in Hebrew. Only now, as I got over the proofs, am I starting to think about the Arab readers. Not that the Jews are the people apart in this area, and the Arab readers look for the punches bag that will make them feel more congenital? Congenial. You know, you know the Jewish readers. Congenial about his political impotence, the Jews will for sure look for a book that will give him an anthropological experience, a rare look into the mind of an Arab, or a book that is a journey into the very heart of Arab society. It's undeniable fact that every time I am invited to an Israeli literary event, I find myself sharing the stage with two belly dancers, an unemployed Arab academic, and a darbuka player. Just this week, I got a call inviting me to some cultural festival. Have I reached Mr. Kashua? Asked the polite woman, and announced, we are very proud to invite you to talk about your new book to an audience of readers. I would be delighted, I replied. Could you please just tell me in a few sentences what the book is about for the program? Of course, the book is about a Jerusalem lawyer who's married and has children. One day the lawyer goes into a used bookstore. Just a minute, excuse me, she said, interrupting. It's not about the conflict? No, not really, but it's a book about the condition of the Arab minority in the land of Israel. No, not exactly. About identity problems, maybe? I wouldn't say that. It's a story about a lawyer. Then I'm sorry, I have to check with my supervisor because we thought... Just a minute. I shouted before she hung up. The lawyer is an Arab. Oh, okay, go on. So the book is about an Arab lawyer with identity problems that have to do with the status of Arab public in the shadow of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That sounds good, she said with an audible sigh of relief. Please go on. He has a wife who's also an Arab, and she certainly has serious problems deriving from the status of Palestinian women within the Arab society in Israel. And how would you sum up the plot in one sentence? In one sentence, I say, taking a moment to articulate my thoughts, I would say that the book is undoubtedly a rare look into a very heart of Arab society. That's the novels. But, thanks. But you know, I think it was part of the this burden on one's shoulder, on a writer's shoulder, from both sides. Not in this funny way, can be tragic sometimes if you live in a place like the Middle East, trying to Israel, Palestine, being a Palestinian and also a citizen of Israel, being some kind of a naive dreamer that one day you can be equal, or at least my kids can be equal in a state, still defines itself, unfortunately, as a Jewish state, as a citizen, it's very frustrating. And yes, as a writer, probably I was criticized from both sides, but still it was a good success. It's good to be criticized. But I think that... that it's a heavy duty. You know, sometimes people think that you're so lucky because you're a writer, you're doing the things that you love to do. That's not true. Writing is difficult. First of all, writing is difficult, period. And it's much more difficult when you find yourself in this situation. From one hand, you're supposed somehow to represent the society that you belong to, because I am part of the Palestinians. I am part of the Palestinian citizens of Israel. Their future is my future, and their identity defined probably more than they defined we defined ourselves. Were defined by the majority as an unwelcomed minority, as a fifth column, as a demographic threat. And on the other hand, writing in Hebrew and having this feeling of being monitored from both sides, also the Israeli side, all the time, that when he's going to make a mistake that proves that all Arabs are the same. Because unfortunately there you cannot afford to think that they are not the same. The enemy should be shaped the same thing with this essential characters or culture, they love to call it, or mentality, they would love to call it, instead of facing political problems, national conflict, land, economical problems. It's much better to blame it on the mentality of the other, of the civilization of the other, of the culture of the other. So yes, it was tough, but I still miss it. It's a lot of materials. And then I realized that the humor, while living there, was a huge tool for me, first of all, maybe more than expressing an idea or trying to deliver an idea for the readers. It was also a great tool for me to survive and make life for myself first bearable, to give a different angle at the situation and try, yes, humor and writing as a tool to survive and maybe also to protect myself and maybe also to protect this group of people that I belong to. Okay, so just one more, I think. Yeah, one maybe, I don't know. So this book is funny, I think. Okay, so actually, I think that there are something like four or five stories about the Nakba Day. Nakba Day is the word that the Palestinians give for the catastrophe. It means the catastrophe. The Nakba is what happened to the Palestinians, and it's the huge and modern history event that shaped the Palestinian identity more than anything else. The Nakba means the establishment of the State of Israel, losing the land, hundreds of thousands of refugees back then, more than 500 villages destroyed. And we remained because, as citizens of Israel, because they just draw the maps in a way that we became citizens of Israel. But we are talking here about the same families who live in Tira. It's just 5 minutes distance from Qalqilya. Qalqilya is in the West Bank, and Tira is in Israel, and we are carrying different IDs. And of course, there's a wall separating Tira and Qalqilya. So it's just the green line that they drew, and we became some kind of separated families or society or nation, although I'm not a huge fan of the definition of nations. So I wrote that piece on the Nakba Day after there was a new law of Nakba legislated in Israel. It's some kind of, because if you mention the Nakba Day, it means that you want to destroy the State of Israel instead of celebrating the Independence Day, which is not true. We always acknowledge the Nakba Day in our house, and we talk about a little bit with the kids about it. But we never desire to destroy the State of Israel. The thing is that I always thought that the first thing that we should do in order to solve maybe the problem and to create a better future is to acknowledge the suffering of the other, and not just to deny it completely. And generally speaking, in Israel, the Nakba and the suffering of the Palestinian is either a lie or they deserve that. So it's very sad. And I wrote that column, I think, in the Nakba Day in that year while students, Arab students, Palestinian students in the Tel Aviv University were demonstrating or making the ceremony for the Nakba Day, and right-wing people, as also the media, were, you know, very much criticizing and attacking them. So I wrote this column. On Nakba Day, I cannot stop thinking about my grandmother. If only she were still alive. If only she were the way I like to remember her. Strong, sharp-witted, always waiting for me after another day at school, off school, sitting on her lamb's wool prayer rug. I would shrug off my heavy book bag and run to her, bury my head in her bosom, and silently weep. "Why are you crying again, my child?" She could sense my body trembling. "They keep picking on me," I would tell her. "They keep picking on me and won't let me breathe." "Who?" she would ask. "Tell me who, and I'll show them what is what." "Everybody," I answer her, "and my friends are worse than the others." "That's how it is," I'd like to hear her say that now, just like then, as she stroked my head. "Because you're a smart boy, the smartest, and they all want to be like you, but they cannot. If I'm so smart, Grandma, then how do you explain the fact that I still haven't figured out how to get along in life? If I'm so smart, how do you explain the terrible fears? And yes, I'm sorry I no longer sleep with a small Quran under my pillow, as you taught me to do when I was young. I want to tell you that it never helped, Grandma. I was always afraid at night. And now more than ever, except I no longer have anywhere to escape to. There is nowhere to hide. And you know, I'm a father now, and I have children who get scared at night and come to me to hide. 3 children, Grandma. Sometimes I tell them the same bedtime stories you used to tell me. I told them how you used to have these huge watermelons that you would load on the backs of convoy of camels to take to the sea to be loaded on boats. I told them about the cows, the donkeys, and the horses, about how on holidays you would dress up in man's clothes, put on an abaya and kufiya, and gallop on the horse together with Grandpa all the way to Jaffa, about the cafe in Jaffa, and how you always told us about the city woman who sat there shamelessly smoking nargila just like the men. "But so did you," I would always say, laughing, and you would answer, "Yes, but no one knew I was a woman. Not like this wanton Jaffa woman. You should have seen them coming into the theater after us and sitting next to us, those loose women, may God roast them in the fires of hell." "But the other stories, Grandma, the ones that made you emotional, that made you cry when you told them, those I haven't yet dared to tell. Sometimes I think I wouldn't want my kids to have to bear the burden, maybe because I want to give them the illusion that a home is a permanent thing, strong, protective, so they wouldn't fear, as I do. A desire lurking, a disaster lurking just beyond the doorstep. So I haven't yet told them that Grandpa was killed in '48 war, and I haven't told them how you became a young widow. I haven't told them about your lands, which were all lost, or about the bullets and the whistle that whistled all around and the shells that fell right and left. I haven't told them about how you hunched over your baby son, my father, in the wheat fields, using your own body to protect him from the fire, and how you always used to say at that point, as if my body would have really protected him. If the fire had caught me, it would have taken him too, but at least I would have died before my son. So I don't tell them that one, or the most terrible of all your stories, about that moment when the shelling ceased and the silence suddenly descended, the moment you tried to go to bring food from the field to your 4 children, and you saw nothing was the same anymore. I remember that look, Grandma, the same look on your face, each one of the thousand of times you described that awful day, always the same look, with eyes glazed over with tears, in just the same way. And I remember you always pulling out your handkerchief with that same delicate motion and saying, in that one moment I understood that everything I had was lost. How hard it is to live with this feeling, with the constant fear of the future, the idea that I must always be prepared for the worst, the feeling that at any moment everything I have could be lost, that a house is never a certainty, and that refugeehood is a sword hanging over me. Meanwhile, I've become a storyteller myself in a language you wouldn't understand, but don't worry, not that many people who speak it really understand. Sometimes I feel I'm basically telling all the same stories I heard from you, and just as you used to do, I repeat them time after time in all different ways and all different forms to no avail. Avail? People here aren't ready to believe your stories, Grandma, or mine. If only you were here now on the Nakba day, I would get on a horse and gallop all the way home, ask your forgiveness for having run away from you in your final days, and bury my head in your bosom for more silent weeping. Why are you crying, my child? If you only knew what I go through, if you only knew how hard it is to tell stories. Who's picking you up? Tell me, and I'll show them what is what. Everybody, Grandma. And what really makes it hurt is I thought they were my friends. That's how it is. I know you would have said as you stroked my head until the trembling stopped, and then you'll say, so, are you hungry? Okay. Thank you. But mostly it's funny columns.
Syed, thank you very much for that very congenial and moving reading. If you have a question, please raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Hi.
Thank you. It sounds like you're allowed free expression by Haaretz. Is there a similarly influential Palestinian paper that allows free expression to Israelis, an Israeli writer?
Well, the problem is that I don't know, and that's a story that it's not that connected. First of all, there are wonderful Palestinian websites that Israelis. For me, just to be clear, it's more important to talk about Palestinian freedom of speech more than if it's a Palestinian newspaper who's giving Israelis the freedom of speech. Somehow it will go together in that sense. So there are wonderful websites that fight for freedom of speech and in Palestine, and the internet is a huge platform for such things. And I think that, it is so sad. Even Haaretz, I always dreamed for writing for Haaretz newspaper. It was always my goal. It's a small, liberal, wonderful newspaper, and we do have the freedom of speech for right-wing Israelis as well in that newspaper. But I'm no longer sure that if we can talk about freedom of speech in Israel. I'm no longer sure that the Minister of Culture monitoring almost every theater play or every movie that's written in Israel can now talk about the freedom of speech of Israel. And not only chasing Palestinians, but also liberal Israelis. I'm not sure that in a state that you published even Zionist wonderful writers like Amos Oz and Gila Almagor as an actress, and others like Shannon Street and singers, that I'm not sure that they're considered even extreme left at all. But because of their political views, they're listed like planted in a mainstream Israeli right-wing organization. Theaters and movie makers that are persecuted by the institution, the Israeli institution, or this new regime. So I'm afraid that I used to say once when I was asked, and they wrote that about that a column, that, you know, when I'm asked what is the thing that you like more than anything else in Israel, and they used to say it's the freedom of speech back then. But I unfortunately no longer can say that. And even if you protect your freedom of speech and still fight for it, even if in newspapers like Haaretz, it still can be very much painful, and you can be treated like some kind of a traitor. And wonderful writers of Haaretz, Israeli ones, sometimes even almost lynched. Unfortunately. So that's true. And of course, if we want to compare Israel to the Arab world, that would be a very big problem, because there isn't a lot of things to be proud about. It's basically sad, and I hope one day it's going to be to change. But I am a citizen that's supposed to live in a democracy, and I would love to compare the Israeli media or the Israeli regime to a democracy. Because that's what they claim that they are. It's a democracy. So you compare it to democratic states, and then you find it's not that democratic. The Arab world is awful. And one of the things that they couldn't... the Arab world is awful. It sounds terrible. I mean, what is going on and what's happening there. One of the sad things that I grew up... You know, I've never been a citizen of any state. I consider myself, until now, I'm not sure how much the state of Israel considers me as a citizen. Never as an equal citizen, but for me it's the only citizenship that I have, and I always try to fight for making that place, that state, that I used to live in, a better place, also for not Jewish people who live there, and so I felt like I failed. So what I'm trying to say is that it's tragic that we were always asked to compare ourselves as Arab minority, Palestinian minority in Israel, not to the Israeli citizens, not to our neighbors from Tira in Kfar Saba or anything like that. We were always supposed to compare ourselves to the refugee camps and poor neighborhoods around the Arab world, but we don't live there. And every nation, if it's the Egyptian, the Syrians, Iraqis, and the others, they have huge problems with their regimes and the same thing we have. And with their dictators and with the rulers. And the same thing we have both in Israel and the occupied territory, a fight with the ruler, with the dictators, with the regime. So I very much hope that democracy and freedom of speech will be part of the media and of the policy of the Middle East, both for Israel and the Middle East. But I don't know.
The gentleman about six rows back with his hand up.
Yeah, hi. I enjoyed your readings, by the way. I'd like to read the rest of the book. I think a growing number of American Jews and Americans dissatisfied are looking for ways to have some beneficial impact on the current state of affairs in the Middle East and Israel, and are not necessarily going to find them in elected people here in America in either party. So I'm sort of curious as to what you would be suggesting for roles or actions of Americans here, and including American Jews, and in particular, historically, boycotts have been an element of nonviolent protest that have had efficacy in some situations, particularly in South Africa, perhaps, in apartheid. And I welcome your views there, knowing, obviously, that boycotts can be double-edged swords and there are complexities to it.
It's a fact. It's a known fact how much the Jewish community in America got huge influence on the state of Israel and also towards the American policy, the White House, when it comes to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And it is sad, sometimes not even clear. I think that Benjamin Netanyahu did his best to show how much he doesn't trust and hate the president of the United States, Obama. And it's sometimes not clear for me at all why the president, who was cursed by the ambassador or attacked verbally by the ambassador of the State of Israel, gives a talk at the embassy of Israel, why Obama did that. So, and one strange thing is meeting always, being invited to, you know, Jewish studies and meeting big groups of Jewish Americans. It's always a surprise for me to realize how liberal they are until it gets to the State of Israel. And I think that it looks that they're not very much aware of what is happening there and what's the meaning of occupation and discriminating. And there is a huge part then that the liberal Americans groups can play, at least not to say yes to right-wing government decisions, any decisions. Almost it looks like AIPAC is supporting any decision of Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. So yes, and I think that it's very important, and Palestinians as well are aware of the fact that it's important to give a different view or to tell a different reality, a different truth, also to the Jewish community here in America, aware of how influential they can be on the politics in the Middle East. So yes, and they have to figure that it's not the same. It's not this diasporic Jewish persecuted people. No, it's a right wing government that I'm sure that the majority of the Jewish community, the way I didn't do a research on that, but would never agree with such policies if the policy were in another place around the world. About the boycott, that's a very complicated thing, because it is sad, and sometimes it looks like nothing is going to help. There's no attention from the Benjamin Netanyahu government to reach any kind of agreement. At least the Palestinians are saying they have this, you know, the Palestinian Authority. I'm not here protecting, by the way, any politicians from any side at all, but at least the Palestinian Authority, let's say that they are the representative of the Palestinian people, they're offering the two-state solution with the borders. They have a plan. The Israeli government doesn't have any plan whatsoever. Just, we'll keep taking the land, you'll be quiet, we were surrounded with wars, and don't just fight. So we don't have any plan coming from this government at all. So sometimes it feels like anything that would help, this feeling that if anything would help. When it comes to economical, you know, boycotting products of the settlements, by the way, there's a law legislated in Israel that I can be arrested if I will support the... Yeah, so yes. So I have to be careful. So I'm not supporting the boycott. Also not on products of the settlements. But what I'm trying to say is I have wonderful colleagues in Israeli academy, and I have wonderful writer friends fighting and accused sometimes of being traitors in the State of Israel. And they no way can call to boycott an event with Edgar Keret or Amos Oz or David Grossman. And they no way can call to boycott professors like Eva Illouz and Hillel Cohen and wonderful professors that I know how much they suffer in the Israeli academia. And they know that they are not always protected by their universities, by the way. Also, the freedom of speech of professors that I know very well is very much limited because of militant groups of students like Im Tirtzu and others that can be awful. And professors are fired just from universities just for saying we are sorry for innocent victims in Gaza, back in the war in Gaza. So it's tragic. And as someone who knows a lot of wonderful academy people in Israel, I'm aware of how difficult it is for them with their students and with their institutions. So it's a complicated thing, and I cannot call for boycotting myself. As I mentioned, yes, I am part of the Palestinian people, but I'm still also a citizen of Israel. And I think that if I call boycotting that, so I would call people also, so I would call also boycotting myself, and they cannot afford doing that meanwhile.
I thank you for writing. I learned about your books through the Forward, the American Jewish newspaper, included you and Israeli writers, so I appreciate them doing that. I'm interested in your writing. Some writers write for themselves, others write to change the world, and I'd wonder how you see your writing. And also, I'm interested in the readership in Israel. I know that your television program was widely watched by Israeli Jews. I wonder about your books. Are your books read by Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, one more than the other?
Yes, because we're still talking about Jewish majority, but... I write in Hebrew. But it's a complicated question. There are no easy questions, I guess. The question is how much, you know, choosing the language, and language is a huge problem. I was not fully aware of how difficult and how important to choose the language, and how much in such a place with a national fight going on. To choose the language of writing can portray you or define your, even, you know, soul, if nationality is part of your soul. And I disagree with that, but you cannot disagree with that in a place full with definitions and roots and identities and things like that, and national ones. So I would very much love to think that I don't censor myself, while writing at least novels. I think that when I write a column, I'm aware of the fact that it's going to be published, and I'm aware of the readers, both Israelis and Arabs. And I think that writing for TV, I'm very much aware of the audience and what I can say and not in commercial primetime TV. And sometimes it's painful. With the TV show, because it was Channel 2, it's the biggest channel, prime time, so it was also something that I was not expecting this success and high rating. So at the beginning, I was harshly even criticized by some Arab newspapers. But towards the end of that, the first season already, the same newspaper have a different thought. And of course, in the second, third, and fourth season, I received much better reviews also in Arab newspapers, because when you are a minority, it's much more harder to criticize or to understand satire and to laugh at yourself. It's easier when you belong to the majority. And so it took a while. The books did very well the three novels were all in for many months in the best selling books and best selling list, we're talking about 20%. That's the percentage of the Arabs, the Palestinian citizens inside Israel, so I'm not sure about how many good readers. You know, I have a wonderful friend who would say that there are a few hundred Arab good readers inside Israel, but it's because we don't have real book industry or market at all. I'm not sure that we can talk about more than six bookshops, real bookstores in Arab towns and villages, not to mention public libraries that can be very rare. And there are no marketing system at all. So no publishing houses, no editors, and no critics for literature. There's nothing to do. And it's a fact. And the fact that my novels were read by more Arabs because of the fact that they were written in Hebrew. An Arab who wants to read a book, he would go to Staimetsky or Tzomet Sfarim or any bookstore in a Jewish town next to his village or town. That's the reality. So I'm very well aware of the. It's a fact that if you want also to reach Arab audience inside Israel, you need to write in Hebrew because they can get your books and they can hear about your books. Wonderful friends of mine who insist on writing in Arabic, like Alaa Hrehel and others, they will just print something like 500 copies on their expenses from. They will pay for that, and they will market it in cafes and sometimes in butcher shops and things like that. So there's no marketing for books in Arabic, almost no bookstores, and So that's the situation. I think that the three novels were translated to Arabic. I said I think because I know that few, maybe just one was like an official way, they bought the rights and everything like that. And then I discovered that the copies, that versions of the books in Arabic are available, which makes me happy. It's complicated to have a deal with Israeli agent, with Israeli publishing house. So I understand sometimes. So for example, the first novel that publishing house in Beirut bought the rights, they did that through my publisher in France, and the book was translated from French. Unlike the other books who were translated directly from Hebrew, I think the translation is much better, but was done in a piratic way? Pirate? Yes. So yes.
Thank you. It was very nice listening to you read. I just would like to know, how has your writing changed? Or have you been influenced differently in the way you write now that you're based in America?
I don't live in America. I live in Urbana-Champaign. No, I'm just kidding. I always promise not to, because the university is really great. It's just flat. It's just flat. And when we landed in Chicago and I was driving from the airport, I remember we just, you know, went out of Chicago and it's something like 2.5 hours drive south to Champaign-Urbana. And I saw the first cornfield and I pointed to my kids, look, it's a cornfield. Like it was magic. And then it was the same cornfield. But we are so. I am sad being there because of what's going, not because of Champagne, but because of what's going back home. Because the first news that I would read, I still need to write my column. I took now 2 weeks vacation because I couldn't stand it and they had a lot of work to do. But I need to deliver a column tonight somehow. So probably it's going to be you. But it's sad because of home, because I miss it, and because it's my language, it's because it's my newspaper, and it's completely different to be there. In one, you know, to be in a, to live in a, I hate that, you know, when I use it, a Jewish neighborhood, because it's not supposed to be like that. There shouldn't be Jewish neighborhoods or Arab neighborhoods in a place that should be a democracy. There should be Western Jerusalem, Eastern Jerusalem, or just a neighborhood. But it is a Jewish neighborhood. Like, there's no room for Arabs in this Jewish neighborhood. It doesn't mean that I didn't have wonderful neighbors living there. But I felt that it was always there, this feeling, and maybe the use of humor, again, to protect myself and to humanize the characters in the family in order to say something a little bit more political and more and more direct. So, you know, I think it's not fair to judge the Palestinian citizen of Israel while everything, every sentence that you can write in Facebook can cause you your job and sometimes even your freedom and to be put in jail for stupid things written in Facebook. And you have no idea what things Israelis are writing in Facebook, awful things. But so I'm trying to say that it's not fair to judge someone who knows that he's kept like a hostage. Economically, when it comes to it, there is nothing like independent Arab economy or anything like that. We just live in the margins of Israel, and that's the sad thing, is this, that you have always to say thank you, even. You know, we know you're discriminated, but still, you know, look at your friends in the Arab world and you still have to thank us, because it's your economy and your education and your life is in our hand. So what I'm trying to say, that it's scary not to feel that fear any longer living here in Champagne. And it was part of my writing, to calculate every sentence, every word, to be aware of losing your job and losing your position if someone doesn't like, or, you know, the way you write. Maybe it's because it became much more extreme than I ever remembered since that summer, 2014. And by the way, we left and we decided to leave before even the attack on Gaza started, the war in Gaza began. It was just to see the situation, racism in Jerusalem, that was enough. to realize that everything is collapsing. And it was traumatic. I think that I'm still fighting that. The first months of moving here to Champaign was absolutely traumatic, like some kind of melancholy. Maybe I'm still dealing with that. So I think that I'm much more, you know, I cannot afford that much of humor because intensive things are happening all the time. And I think since I moved, I'm more politically direct and more right about the political situation, less about family life or family experience the way that I used to do back in Jerusalem. And again, I'm not sure if it's the extreme situation getting just worse with the time back home in Israel, or it is because of the of being away, missing, and even more scared now. I don't know if it was a madhouse or a crazy place, violent place when I lived there, and I felt it. And I don't know if it now looks even much more difficult and much more violent. Maybe because I'm a little bit away and they can see the whole picture and the whole building. So I think, yes, very much it influenced my writing. And to be honest, I was thinking to quit. It's my editors, and it's Haaretz. It's such an important newspaper, and wonderful people work there that keep convincing me that my heart still should be heard there. But I don't know. We will see. I'm still not sure about what I'm doing.
We'll have to leave it on that note of uncertainty. Please join me in thanking Syed Kashua.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.